They tell you that the perfect society, four social classes, Canto 7, Chapter 11, Text 30. Among mixed classes known as Shankara, those who are not thieves are known as Antevashayi, or Chandalas, dog-eaters, and they also have their hereditary customs. Purport. The four principal divisions of society, Brahmana, Kshatriya, Vaishya, and Shudra, have been defined, and now there is a description of the Antija, the mixed classes. Among the mixed classes, there are two divisions, Pratilomaja and Anulomaja. If a woman of a high caste marries a man of lower caste, their union is called Pratilo. Yeah. If a woman of a low caste, however, marries a man of a higher caste, their union is called Anulo. Members of such dynasty have their traditional duties as barbers, washermen, and so on. Among the Antijas, those who are still somewhat pure, in that they do not steal and are not addicted to meat-eating, drinking, illicit sex, and gambling, are called Antevasayi. Among people of the lower classes, intermarriage and drinking of wine are allowed, for these people do not recognize such conduct as sinful among themselves. So here is mentioning, so these are the pure natures, then of the Brahman, Kshatriya, Vaishya, and Shudra. Then when these are mixed, then you end up with all kinds of interesting personalities. So then Prabhupada mentions here the traditional duties, they end up as barber, washerman, they're used as spies, they do all kinds of, you know, strange and wonderful things, you know, all over here. Necessary things. But this is only if they are not that they are not thieves. That's a very important thing. If the thieves are not allowed to stay in where the other people live, thieves have to go to the forest. They can't stay around. It's not allowed. Because in the human society, the people have to be able to feel safe and protected. And you can't feel safe if there's thievery. So this aspect of taking other people's things, you know, is not proper. That should be very much avoided. So here, the aspect of why the mixed caste is not considered so good, while when you mix, even though they're higher classes, you mix a Brahmin or a Kshatriya or like this, why it's not considered so good is because the natures are different. When you have two persons of the same nature, then the child would be very clear in their nature. But if there's a mixed nature, then the child will have some confusion. They want to do this, same time they want to do that. You know, you see many, many times like this, children who... they're very much into deity worship and things like this. At the same time, they're totally into business. Because if you see, you know, the mother's a head pujari, you know, the father's into business. And then you end up with, and it's very difficult for them. Sometimes they have a lot of problems. It means that they work it out eventually. It just takes them a little bit longer to figure out what is their... do a business of deity worship. Like that. So then it just takes them a little bit longer. They get confused for some time. So when they kind of hit the, you know, especially the late teens, early 20s, they're not quite sure, and then they kind of like, they have to get themselves settled. And then eventually they kind of work it out. But if the nature of the parents is very similar, then the child will be very similar. And then it's just very easily they take example from the parents. They just immediately, you know, see what they want to do, and they focus. Because if you're focused on one thing, it makes life easier. If you're focused on many things, it makes life more difficult. Vyavasayatmika buddhi, a.k.a. Hakuru Nandana. The determination is one-pointed. It makes it a lot easier. So we are one-pointed on our Krishna consciousness, But how we're going to engage ourselves in Krishna consciousness, that should also be one-pointed. We should understand, these are the duties, this is what I'm going to do. And these are the duties, this is what I'm going to do. So then we want to avoid the difficulties where one doesn't know what to do, because then one can't figure out what to do for Krishna. We're supposed to take our nature, engage in Krishna's service. But now if we can't figure out exactly what is our nature, what are our priorities, it makes it more difficult. But the point is it doesn't matter. Because whether you work it out today or tomorrow, as long as you work it out, then that's the main thing, you know. And when Prabhupada was talking about Westerners, he says, you know, that mixes of mixes, you know. Here they're talking about pure mixes, you know. Bona fide Kshatriya, bona fide Brahman or Vaishya. You mix that and then you get, you know, the natural Pratilomi, Anuloma, like that. But then when you mix mixes, you know, the chandalas with the others like this, you know, the antijas, when they are all mixed together, then you end up with really wild things, you know, because you can't really work it out what, you know, you end up with, instead of having two choices, then sometimes you have four, you know, like the father, they're aligned, they're kshatriyas, but because they lost all the land of partition, so then they take up, you know, becoming businessmen. So you have these two mentalities on the father's side. Then the mother's side is they're from, you know, Shudra background, but they somehow or another themselves have developed somewhat of a Brahminical nature. So they're into deity worship, this and that. But to make a living, they also do business. So then this businessman and businesswoman, they meet, and then when they have their child, then he has all these problems. He likes the Brahminical atmosphere, gets worried about justice like the Kshatriyas, sees everything through the eyes of, you know, profit and loss, and, you know, has a little bit of a, you know, has a difficulty in their sadhana and stuff like that. So you end up with like that. So all these far out things you end up with. So one, you know, so this is, therefore, the Manu Samhita, it stresses that in a marriage that the husband and wife should be of equal nature, because then they can relate to each other for their own benefits, and then the children will be able to relate to them and relate to, will be able to find their own direction. Because when you make, it means, it doesn't have it here, I think Garuda Puran mentions it. It's not that when you mix a Brahmin and a Kshatriya, that you end up just with a, you know, slightly sattvic Kshatriya or a little bit Rajasic Brahmin. You end up with something totally different. Right? Like that. You end up, like you take, you know, you take, you know, you take arrowroot powder, which is dry and all that, and you take milk, which is wet, you know? Like that, some powder, nothing edible, and then you end up with some custard. It's completely different from either of them. So you end up with totally different things. The chemical reaction ends up with something totally different. So one has to be considerate of that. Because one is the husband and wife have to be able to live together, and two, they also have to think of the children. If they're planning to have children, they have to think of the children. That's very much a, at least in the contemporary scenario, is very much left out of the consideration. Generally, when a man and woman are looking for compatibility, they're looking simply for their own compatibility and their own what they want. They don't really consider children. Antija means mixed caste. They're just mixed, you know. Yeah, just so many things mixed together. Like that, yes.
It seems that if the husband and wife are not matched, they won't be peaceful together. Yeah. So naturally the child that will be born will also not be peaceful.
Yeah, but he may not relate to either of them. Some mixes will get some similar qualities, some mixes don't. They get something very different. You know? Like that. But it's a mentality. It doesn't necessarily mean like here. It says the antevasai, it means, it says here, among the mixed classes known as Shankara, those who are not thieves are known as antevasai. Antevasai, or chandalas, dog eaters. So it's not necessarily that they may have the habits of the dog eater, that they're actually out there eating dogs, right? But that they have the mentality of a dog eater. That's the thing. From the mentality, then you get these kind of activities. So the dog eater generally means one who is not very, you know, the consciousness is not that high, you know, like that. But that's if they're not thieves. So that's one thing, good thing to know. At least the dog eaters are not thieves. Right? So if you meet any chandalas, then like that. So it mentions here, Prabhupada's mentioning, among the yantijas, those who are still somewhat pure in that they do not steal and are not addicted to meat eating, drinking, illicit sex, and gambling are called antevasai. Like that. And it mentions here, people of the lower classes, intermarriage and drinking of wine are allowed because they don't care. It's already so crazy, so a little more craziness, you know. Like that. I mean, they don't recognize it as, it's allowed, it doesn't mean that they won't get the reaction, but they're not, the king doesn't bother punishing them. That'll be taken care of by their own things. Plus, because of the lower nature, the reactions aren't so high, you know, as we see in the next verse here. 31. My dear king, Brahmanas well conversant in Vedic knowledge have given their verdict that in every age, yuga, the conduct of different sections of people according to their material modes of nature is auspicious both in this life and after death. Purport. In Bhagavad Gita 3:35 it is said, Shrayan svadharamo viguna paradharamat svanushtitat. It is far better to discharge one's prescribed duties, even though they may be faulty, than another's duties. The antijas, the men of the lower classes, are accustomed to stealing, drinking, and illicit sex, but that is not considered sinful. For example, if a tiger kills a man, this is not sinful, but if a man kills another man, this is considered sinful, and the killer is hanged. What is a daily affair amongst the animals is a sinful act in human society. Thus, according to the symptoms of higher and lower sections of society, there are different varieties of occupational duties. According to the experts in Vedic knowledge, these duties are prescribed in terms of the age concerned. Wow, it's right here. The word nishkama is used. This is amazing, even though many devotees say it is not. Right here, used by Narad Muni himself, and Prabhupada quotes it in the purport. Okay, so, no, it's the next verse, we'll get to that. It's just, it's nishkam, because we mentioned nishkam karma, and then many devotees will say, Prabhupada doesn't use that, it's not our concept, that's Baladev, that's Vishwanath, that's this one, that's that one. Somehow or another, it's right here in Prabhupada's Bhagavatam, spoken by Narad Muni, and then used by Prabhupada in the purport. Oh, maybe it was a... So here we see here is that in human society these four activities are considered sinful, and acting improperly is considered sinful. But in the animal society, then they are not so much. So the antijas means two-legged animals. That's basically, they're in a human form, but they're not civilized. Out of the 400,000 forms of human life, then Lord Chaitanya tells Sanatan Goswami, only a few are civilized. Most are not civilized. Their habits are not to, you know, follow nicely the dharma that is given coming down from the Lord. Or they have their own dharmas that have been manifest for them. So if they engage in so many different things, it is bad, they'll get reactions, but it won't be as bad as those who are more qualified if they act improperly. Because one who actually has knowledge, then if for him to behave badly is not good. But someone who doesn't have knowledge, if they behave badly, some reaction is there if they're in the human form. But it'll be much less than someone who has knowledge. Right? Because the animals are in ignorance, therefore they don't know any better. They just act according to their instinct. They're totally pushed by the modes. So then they are doing their duties. Right? So then all these antyajas, then they behave how they are then. But the point is human life is meant for going back to Godhead. So even though it may not be considered, you know, as sinful as others, they're addicted to sinful activities and so in this way. But it's still, it's not, and they'll be left alone, you know, but they live outside. They don't live in the main cities. They live outside. And they don't have any influence on the civilized society. But unless they take up Krishna consciousness and then give up their sinful ways, then there's no benefit. Even if it's, one may say, oh, it's not so sinful for them. But the problem is there's no benefit to it. Just like being very pious, if one is not Krishna conscious, there's no great benefit. Being impious and not Krishna conscious also has no benefit. So that should be understood. Text 32. Oh yeah. Oh, so that's, no. So another point is that it's better to perform one's own duty than someone else's. Because whatever the nature is, if you follow that, one will become perfect. You just do what is your nature, but do it for Krishna, and it is perfect. Like that. That's all. It's not that in the material consideration, you'll say one is higher and lower. So that's just for social structure. You have to have some structure. There must be some kind of system of interaction so that things can get done. But when it's engaged in Krishna's service, it doesn't matter. You know, it doesn't matter what is being engaged. It's all Krishna's service. Text 32. If one acts in his profession according to his position in the modes of nature and gradually gives up these activities, he attains the nishkama stage. Purport. One gradually gives up his hereditary customs and duties and tries to serve the Supreme Personality of Godhead in his natural position. He is gradually able to become free from these activities, and he attains the stage of nishkama, freedom from material desires. So in other words, he's saying, whatever your position, act in that. So you're an antyaja, you're a barber, you just do that. But now, start to do it for Krishna, with understanding your relationship with Krishna, your need to serve Krishna. Then one will find that by doing that, one gives up, the modes of nature start to go, and then one becomes liberated by that same activity. Right? So he becomes free from material desire. So one doesn't have to change his position. You give up the attachment, you give up the modes, but the activities can go on. And then slowly, slowly, even those will then start to, once the mentality is gone, then naturally the activities change. And if we have a materialistic mentality, there's no need to give up one's material facilities. One just starts to engage them in Krishna's service. Then, with time, the mentality becomes purified. Then one doesn't have a materialistic nature. And then as one becomes purified by engaging the facilities in Krishna's service, then slowly, slowly one has no more attachments to these things. And as it becomes favorable, they can be given up. Right? Then one comes to the Paramahamsa stage. One doesn't need any form of religious duties. One's religious duty is simply remembering the Lord. My dear king, if an agricultural field is cultivated again and again, the power of its production decreases, and whatever seeds are sown there are lost. Just as drops of ghee on a fire never extinguish the fire, but a flood of ghee will. Similarly, overindulgence in lusty desires mitigates such desires entirely. Purport. If one continuously sprinkles drops of ghee on a fire, the fire will not be extinguished. But if one suddenly puts a lump of ghee on a fire, the fire may possibly be extinguished entirely. Similarly, those who are too sinful and have thus been born in the lower classes are allowed to enjoy sinful activities fully, for thus there is a chance that these activities will become detestable to them, and they will get the opportunity to be purified. So, therefore, the kings wouldn't bother these people. Of course, they're not doing these. They're not opening nightclubs and all these different things in the town. They're out and, you know, out wherever they are. So they don't bother them, because by trying to restrict them, they have no taste for restriction and regulation. So then the difficulty will come up that they won't, it'll just increase their desires. I've seen it happen, you know, times that when devotees get into really strict vows, like Chaturmasya and that, those who take it really strictly, I've seen a few cases that right after Chaturmasya is finished, then they get married or go off and do something really wild like that. You know, like that. I've seen that happen. Because it's just the senses can't handle so much restriction. So it doesn't put out the fire, it increases it. So that's why one shouldn't do anything heavier than what one can follow. Because then it only brings out bad qualities. That is seen. So when Prabhupada recommends, he says austerity, then he says, you know, gives things like taking bath twice a day, you know, fasting on Ekadasi, following the four regulative principles, chanting Hare Krishna, taking only prasad. These are austerities. Because for a sinful person, they are. For someone else, they're not. But they're the perfection of austerities. There's some restriction. It's very simple, very easy. And it gives the topmost results. So for the sinful people, they will do whatever they're doing outside. Therefore also, people who are interested in Krishna consciousness and the congregation, that they haven't come up to the standard yet, they stay in their house, they do whatever they're doing. We just encourage them in whatever they're doing. You know, we encourage them to chant and let's come to the temple, take prasad. But if what they do at their house, whatever they may do. Then, with time, then they'll slowly become burnt out by these things. There's every chance that before becoming a devotee, they've been burnt out by just too much overindulgence and all nonsense. Therefore, it's let go on. You know? It's let go on. But not where it will disturb other members of the society who can follow nicely and can, by their regulation, advance. Someone who's trained, who's cultured, by regulation, they actually become satisfied and purified, and they advance. Someone who's not trained, then you give them that, and then the problem is then they have difficulty. The restriction creates problems for them. Like that. Yes.
Maharaj, I have heard many times that it is a used method of bringing out the anarthas by pushing someone over his limit so that the bad qualities can come up and then can be dealt with. Is it a good
way? You can, as long as one is going to be totally there to take care of whatever is created from that. Right? Means if the pushing is done just to bring that out, and that's fine, but if the pushing is done there just to get more money coming in for the Sankirtan, and then when it comes up, then you start yelling at them for their anarthas and then throw them out, then that's not so good. One has to be very careful. You know, by pushing and by just having a very steady thing, you see the anarthas. You know, when you have a very strict program and like that, then it'll be obvious. Because when you're more spaced out, you don't notice them. When the program becomes more tight, then you notice what anarthas are there. Then that leader has to be willing and able to deal with them. You know, at least attempt how much they can. Because the point is that someone should try to be able to bring others up to their own level, like that. And then it works nicely. So then, up to their own level, or if they can, beyond it. You know, that's it. Prabhupada also mentions that the teacher doesn't have is very happy if someone can, a student can surpass them. Like that. It's not that they're thinking that they should never surpass. They may, but that's not a problem. Like that. We never see in any of the big acharyas that their spiritual master ever had any problem with them being greater. Like that. Because the point is everyone has their nature. Everyone has their Krishna conscious, you know, platform. So someone's platform is can go quickly up to a higher stage, then one is happy to help. One is not looking for a position. One won't help somebody or only so much because then they may, you know, take over your position. That's not the thing. Therefore, that's why Brahmins, it's recommended that Brahmins do the teaching. Because if the Brahmin is very qualified, then there won't be any problem with the student becoming more knowledgeable than them in the subject. But we see that those who actually do get better, then they have the character that they always follow the etiquette. Like Lord Chaitanya is more prominent than Ishwara Puri, but Lord Chaitanya always has the proper etiquette in dealing with Ishwara Puri. Like that. Ramanuja is more prominent than Yumanacharya or which is other? Nathamuni and who did he take Diksha from? Who? Rama Mishra. You know, who's ever even heard of Rama Mishra? We've at least heard of, you know, Yamunacharya. Yadav Prakash. Yeah, well, we heard of him. Yeah. You know, like that. But then he became a devotee afterwards, isn't it?
Yeah.
He became a devotee. Yeah.
Very old.
Yeah. So then, but the etiquette is always there. They always speak well because they know that because the person helped, they've been able to go to whatever position they've gone to. Because the Lord comes to them through that person. This is a very essential point in the Vaishnav culture or Siddhanta is that the if someone is qualified, even if these teacher is less qualified, they can still take advantage because a lot of learning is gained from oneself. You gain one quarter of your knowledge from the teacher. You gain one quarter there. Then one quarter you gain from your own study. One quarter by association and one quarter by experience. Like that. So the teacher, what he speaks to you, you can absorb that, you know, so much. Then you have to get that confirmed by others and then in your own experience. Then you can fully, and then when you read it in the Shastras. So what the Smashal speaks is one quarter of your learning. Though that will be then realized more and more by as you study, by you associate, and by you engage in your different activities and you get that experience. So I think that's from Manusamhita. Either that or that's from the Saptapada Brahmana. Something. It's in the paper there. I think it mentions where that's from. Like that. I think it's from there or from the Upanishads. You know? But that's what one gains in that way. Because you hear, but you have to also, to use it, you have to realize. You know? So that comes from just the application and association.
No, I said tolerance or acceptance of Loka's behavior by Loka's people versus coming from a position of analyzing things in terms of the modes that are dominating rather than.
Yes.
So it's just that kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah. It means they're not allowed to do all their nonsense in where other civilized people are. But if they're in their own place, in their own villages, and doing all that, who cares? You know, just like you would have even the Vedic time in the Mahabharata time, then you had the kings from Gandhar, you know, where Gandhari is from, and that's Afghanistan. The people over there are sinful. They're addicted to all kinds of sinful activities and this and that. And then But the kings leave them in their customs, as long as they don't steal and fight and kill each other and stuff like that. Then, you know, like that. But otherwise, if they just follow the basic rules of culture, then, you know, they do whatever they're doing. And in, you know, Andhra, then you find that the villages there are very much, many of them are very attached to sinful activities, you know, like that. It's just very natural for them. So that would be allowed because they just, you know, they can't kill cows and open slaughterhouses and just like that, but just in their own simple way, you know, they, you don't open big alcohol, you know, breweries and stuff. They make their own local brew and, you know, stuff like that. You know, they roll their own cigars, you know. And under, they just take the big tobacco leaves and just roll them together. So you end up with this, you know, I don't know, like 9-10 inch, you know, half inch thick cigar. No, maybe a little less. Yeah, maybe half inch thick cigar. That it's not uncommon that you see, you know, 70-80 year old shaved heads widows smoking. You know, but that's just the class of people that they are. You know. And this is outside the, you know, they've gone to Tirupati and others to go take darshan, and while they're outside, you know, waiting around for others, and they sit around and smoke these big cigars. Yeah, like that, which is quite amazing, you know. I don't think they have the refinement of the, you know, Havana cigars or something. But yes.
From a practical side, nowadays, how that can be executed? That, let's say, you want to build a society again, and we have what we have. Then we have to move all those people out of the cities. Then the cities would be empty. Or
you don't have to worry about that. We're not dealing on a level where we're dealing with whole cities. We have our, you know, our temple or our little community. So those who have can very naturally follow the pure standards. They live in the temple, or they live in the immediate community, your core community. Those that have a little bit more difficulty, then they'll live just outside the community. They'll live in their own places and that. And the more they're in, like they go towards the feral side, then the more they stay out on the edges. You know, like that. And so they come to the festivals and take advantage of, but they live in their own place, take care of themselves, and, you know. Mm-hmm. You just, in other words, you just encourage them on the Krishna conscious side. The strictness is there on those who can handle the strictness. And those who can't, then they should live outside, and you encourage them in what they can do for Krishna. Rather than, in other words, all those, you don't tell them they're in Maya. If they come and they ask and they want to help and get out of that, then you might point out what are the little technicalities of their Maya. But otherwise, you have a devotee who lives outside, does whatever he does, rather than say so much in Maya, then you comment how nice it is that he does, you know, visit the temple every Janmashtami. You know, they're doing what they can. That's all the more they can handle. So they come once a year or once a month, or to the Sunday feast, just at the Prashad time, and miss the feast and the Kirtan, you know, like that. So then encourage in that. And if that's encouraged, then you'll see they'll slowly come up. But if it's just told they're in Maya, they know they're in Maya, but the difficulty is they can't get out of it. That attachment is there. So therefore, by here, you just encourage the Krishna conscious side. And they're naturally going to burn themselves out anyway on the material side. Material nature is very expert at that. We don't have to worry. She knows how to burn people out. That's her expertise, like that. I mean, there's nobody she hasn't burnt out at some point. You know, she gets everybody. You know, so that will be taken care of. We just simply have to encourage. But depending upon their level in this, then they will get. They will deal in such a way as their influence and all that. Like someone may be a good manager, and that, but not good in spiritually. So therefore, let them manage things that just need management, but they wouldn't deal, like, let's say, with the spiritual lives of the devotees. They wouldn't, let's say, deal with the schedule. They wouldn't make the schedule. They wouldn't necessarily make the menus. They wouldn't make, you know, the classes and educational arrangements for the devotees and the standards in the temple, like that. You know, they may come to the temple every day just in their, you know, in their karmic clothes and all this and that. So they don't set those standards, but they may just manage certain things, and that's it. And you encourage them that way. But they should also, it should be, you know, clearly pointed out that this is their weakness, so therefore they shouldn't extend beyond what they can do. Just like they don't want anybody telling them, you know, pushing on them that, you know, why they don't come to the morning program, or why they don't do this, and why they don't wear devotional clothes, and all this and that. You know, why they use toilet paper, you know, stuff like this. You leave them alone. Same way as they should reciprocate. They leave those alone who can follow strictly, and in no way consider that they have any right to poke their nose there. If they see something wrong, they can say something, but they shouldn't be the managing authority to deal with it. So in this way, you can balance and engage people according to their nature. And especially when you have festivals and big programs, then anybody who has an ability in something, you just let them do that at that time. Because it's short, everybody's absorbed in all that, and, you know, very minimal. Someone's very good at organizing or dealing with big people or, you know, getting permissions or raising funds or, you know, like that, then they can take part in these big festivals, and they happen for a few, you know, a day, a few days, a few weeks, and then it's over. And then naturally, the whatever little bit of, you know, determination was there, they can last for that long. You have to judge that. Because when there's too much passion, ignorance, they can't do anything for very long, unless they're getting benefit from it, material benefit. But something for Krishna, then they'll do. They know, okay, it's a week program, big Rath Yatra, big something, and for that week they can push it. They can put money in, they can put time in, you can put their energy. And then after that, then let them sit back. And then don't worry, okay, they've gone back to whatever they were. You should see that they've done this nice thing. You know? They've done this nice week of preaching and organizing, and they're remembered for that. Not that, you know, the guy then, you know, for the next 6 months or 1 year is going to sit at the house and not do a whole lot for Krishna. Like that. So one has to just see their position and leave that there. But as we will note, for those who can be trained, for those who can be more cultured, then we're very strict with. So those who live in the temple, we're very strict with. Like that. Because those who have that nature will be encouraged. Right? Nothing annoys someone who can be strict more than being surrounded by people who are not. You can, huh?
Once again.
Nothing disturbs someone who is very strict in their sadhana, service attitude, you know, like, and you know, culture, just in proper etiquette, than having to live with people who are not. You know, you'll find that with a handful of people, you can get enthusiastic Krishna conscious people, you can get more done than having a whole temple full of, you know, half quarter Krishna conscious lazy people. Because those who can work won't work and can't do their full amount. Because they start and the other people just drag them down and they lose their enthusiasm. So if you have a small group of very enthusiastic people, they can enthuse and preach to a whole community and cultivate and bring them up. But if you have people that don't belong in the temple, that should be in the community but are in the temple, then your temple is not inspiring to the rest of the community. You know, you'll find this many places. You have a temple, 15, 20 devotees in it. You have 300 devotees living outside. The 300 devotees won't have anything to do with the temple. Because those in the temple, they don't see as the kind of people they can really look up to. They see them as just the same as them, just they haven't burned out yet. And so it's just a matter of time before they're living out in the community. Rather than, these are devotees that, you know, really are, you know, living the philosophy, set good example, are very encouraging in their word and behavior. So then that attracts them. They want to come and hear from them. They want to be trained by them. They want to invite them to the houses for programs. they want to help in some way that they can, or give donations or something like that. Because then the core group is very, very strong. Then it works very good. Otherwise, it doesn't. That's what Prabhupada kept saying, boil the milk. You know? It means that now you have to raise the standard. And as you raise the standard, if you raise the standard in the temple, and those who can't maintain the standard, they're encouraged to, you know, move into a situation that's comfortable for them. And they're encouraged to continue in service and in some, you know, always try to help in that way. Then the whole community will go up. Like that. By keeping those in the temples and that can encourage, then the congregation will automatically go up. Like that. Because they'll see something that inspires them. Like that. Does that make some sense? Mm-hmm. Like that, yeah.
So as you talk a lot about the influence of the modes on one's activities, it also seems to be the nature of one's faith. Obviously it has a lot of influence on activity.
In which meaning?
Meaning that the nature of one's faith would have a very strong impact on the consciousness and the speech and activity of the person.
Because from the modes, that's going to see varnashram means you're dealing mainly with the you're dealing with identifying what is the conditioned nature, and then understanding the rules and regulations that match that nature, and then how to engage that in Krishna's service. So that's what the whole process there of the varnashram is for identifying that nature. So that's all by the modes. You know, Kshatriya and Brahman is prominently goodness. Kshatriya is prominently passion with, you know, like this, with the touch of goodness. Or the goodness is there in the way of that they do things according to Shastra. And they do things in consultation with the Brahmins. And they're establishing the religious principles. They won't whack by whim is not... there. Means even though they may be whimsical, it's still within the realm of the Shastra. It's not whimsical in the realm of the mind. Then Vaishya is passion and ignorance, because with the ignorance there, then you get that kind of whimsicalness, the senses, and that just doing whatever you like to do. You know, whether it's if it's lined up with Shastra, great. You know, then it's like, besides my senses being pleased, you know, my mind being pleased, I also get some pious or devotional credit. So that's, you know, double benefit, double profit. But otherwise, the main thing is just their profit. And then Shudra is predominantly ignorance, because then there's they're dealing specifically with the mind. Art means mind, like that. So it's just the field of their occupation. And then along with that, the mind like that, then there's always the difficulty of lamentation. One has a tendency to lament, because the mind is not steady. It goes this way, it goes that way. And so that anxiety, that's why then the name Shudra comes up, just meaning one who always laments. But as discussed before, the 30 qualities that are there of human society, Shudras are human. You know, Shudra may be the lowest on the list, the Brahma Kshatriya Vaishya Shudra, but that's within human life. Then below that is then everything else. All this mixed, the Shankara, these mixed varnas, where they're interested in sinful life, sinful activities. So in the Vedic things, Shudras aren't. Sometimes it'll be mentioned, it's, you know, the addiction to the senses and to, you know, lamentation and other such things may be applied in a broader spectrum, that anything that's kind of related to that. But if we technically look at it, then you're generally talking about the antijas. Because the Shudras have very good qualities. Just that within the realm of those good qualities, they happen to lament a little bit more and be disturbed a little bit more than the Brahma Kshatriyas Vaishyas. You know? So you're talking about they have some mental disturbance. Vaishyas a little less than that, Kshatriyas less than that, Brahmas less than that. But the antijas, then it's a complete circus, you know. It's a complete madhouse. So the contemporary world is just the antija society. So they actually don't really know what is the higher principle. If they understood, it's like, you know, it's like, what do you call it? You know, just like you have the emperor, then you have big kings, and then you have small kings. The small king, he's the bottom of the pile. But for a common person, a king is, you know, big, wealthy, influential. He's a lot more than what they have. Like that. So they want to become rich and famous and all that. So for someone who's on the common level, even becoming a small king is pretty good. You know, being able to come up to that level. So when one comes from the background of the Mlechas and Yavanas, even just coming to the platform of a Shudra and engaging those activities in Krishna's service is very elevated. Very elevated. You know, as far as occupational duty. And then you have on top of it the aspect of the Daiva Varnashram. Whatever you do for Krishna doesn't matter. It's pure. It purifies you, and you become a devotee, you go back to Godhead. So therefore it says, better to do your own duty than someone else's. Why would you do someone else's? Because you feel there's more profit or more prestige. Like that. You know? Why do it? If I have the nature of washing pots or driving, and my interest in getting involved in deity worship because I think it'll be more prestigious, I'll probably find I create more problem there than if I drive. If I drive, I'm very happy and everybody else is happy. I do puja, I'm not happy and no one else is happy. So for the sake of some facility, better to just stick to one's own thing and do it very nicely, and one will go back to Godhead. You know, so it's a very interesting thing. So here is that the kings would allow that if there is some difficulty like this, it's allowed, but they're out on the edge. You know, antija also means, you know, who lives in the forest, I think. Yeah, like the, yeah, isn't it? Yeah, born outside the Varnashram. Oh. Yeah, like the brahmacharis known as antevasan. They live out in the forest, like that. So antyaja means one who's born in the forest. I guess they mean the forest of material enjoyment, concrete jungle. Yes. A little loudly.
And this one, Hari Patel was talking, I remember being in South India sometime before, and then a little bit with congregation. So we see that many times the congregation devotees have lots of problems. So when they kind of spend lots of time together and they become very familiar with each other and they deal on the platform of these problems and they discourage each other, you know, what about this? Or you do this wrong and you do this wrong. And they kind of, you know, just see the bad sides and then become very discouraged to do anything at all. But when they meet sometimes and they engage in some kind of preaching activities in the temples like Ratayatras and stuff like that, so they see each other, you know, working very hard and being very enthusiastic. So in this way they, you know, get the good side, they become encouraged by each other instead of being discouraged by each other. So just a kind of, you know, nice application, whatever you said, but actually, you know, it works very nicely.
Okay. Text 35. If one shows the symptoms of being a Brahmana, Kshatriya, Vaishya, or Shudra, as described above, even if he has appeared in a different class, he should be accepted according to those symptoms of classification. Purport. Herein it is clearly stated by Narad Muni that one should not be accepted as a Brahmin, Kshatriya, Vaishya, Shudra according to birth. For although this is going on now, it is not accepted by the Shastras. As stated in Bhagavad Gita 4.13, Chaturvarnyam Mayashrishtam Guna Karma Vibhaga Shaha. Thus the four divisions of society, Brahmana, Kshatriya, Vaishya, and Shudra, are to be ascertained according to qualities and activities. If one was born in a Brahmana family and has acquired the Brahminical qualifications, he is to be accepted as a Brahmana. Otherwise, he should be considered a Brahmabandhu. Similarly, if a Shudra acquires the qualifications of a Brahmana, although he was born in a Shudra family, he is not a Shudra. Because he has developed the qualities of a Brahmana, he should be accepted as a Brahmana. The Krishna consciousness movement is meant to develop these brahminical qualities, regardless of the community in which one was born. If one develops the qualities of a brahmana, he should be accepted as a brahmana, and he then may be offered the order of sannyas. Unless one is qualified in the terms of the brahminical symptoms, one cannot take sannyas. In designating a person, a brahman, kshatriya, vaishya, or shudra, birth is not the essential symptom. This understanding is very important. Herein Narad Muni distinctly says that one may be accepted according to the caste of his birth if he has the corresponding qualifications, but otherwise he should not. One who has attained the qualifications of a brahmana, regardless of where he was born, should be accepted as a brahmana. Similarly, if one has developed the qualities of a shudra or a chandala, regardless of where he was born, he should be accepted in terms of those symptoms. Thus end the Bhaktivedanta purports of the 7th canto, 11th chapter of the Srimad Bhagavatam, entitled The Perfect Society, Four Social Classes. So here now is pointed out that all these different things, and now whatever the birth is, that is qualities that one has. That is how it's seen. The Asuric Varnashram means that by birth, that is the qualification only. You're born in a Brahmin family, you're a Brahmin. You're not born in a Brahmin family, you cannot be a Brahmin. That's the Asuric Varnashram. Daiva Varnashram means according to the nature that you have, the qualities, guna and karma, then whatever the family you're born in doesn't matter. Generally, you will find when the parents are brahminical, then the child has the best opportunity to become brahminical, because then they see the qualities of the parents, they naturally imbibe those. They're produced from the mix of the consciousness of the parents, so, and by the association of the parents and that community, they'll generally develop. But if they don't develop, they can't be accepted as a brahmana. And even someone is born in a lower family, but they have the good nature, then that is accepted, just like we see Vidura. He is born as a Shudra. But he has all the knowledge of a great, highly advanced personality, of a Brahmana. You know? So in the Daiva Varnashram, he's accepted that way. Therefore, his instructions and all that are accepted in Srimad Bhagavatam. Though socially, then, there at the time, because they're working more on the Asura, because they're living with a bunch of Asuras, you know, Duryodhana and all them. So then it just goes. Duryodhana doesn't have the character of a Kshatriya. He's not actually a good Kshatriya. He can administrate very nicely, but he is not able to protect the people. So he's not actually a proper Kshatriya. Yudhishthira is, but he can't appreciate Yudhishthira, therefore he's unqualified. So by birth is going on. So naturally then, you know, Vidura is in the same clan, and he's not accepted as an advanced personality. He's, you know, insulted. So then he just leaves. So this is the position there. Yes?
I'm sorry. I read in the Mahabharata that the subjects of Duryodhana, they like Duryodhana very much. Because he was a good king, this is what it is said there.
He's good king in that he was able to administrate nicely. But if we see fully what a king is supposed to do, the king is supposed to represent the shelter potency of the Lord, you know, and the management potency. So Prithu, he's a good king. You know, Yudhishthira is a good king, Ramachandra is a good king. These are real kings because they care for the spiritual welfare of the citizens. So the citizens, being common people, then they can very easily become, you know, distracted from the path. That's the thing, is that the Vaishyas and the Shudras can very easily become distracted. They're devotees, but they can become distracted. You know, they just, certain things come up and they become very important in their life and they get distracted, you know. You know, like that. So then that is where the good king and in under the counsel of good brahmanas must deal. But it's like, do we ever hear of Duryodhana and his brahmins? Have you ever heard of one instance of Duryodhana sitting with some qualified brahmins? No. So then how can he be a good king? It looks good to the public. The economy is steady. The kingdom is protected. Like that. So they don't have any disturbance from thieves and all that. So that's fine. But spiritually, they're not getting anywhere. So that is also the duty of the king. So because Yudhishthira is there, and it's his right to be the king, and he can see that the subjects are not being trained in Krishna consciousness. So then it's his duty then, if he has the facility, then to establish his position so that the people can become trained in Krishna consciousness, so they get a complete protection. Like that. That is their business. Because a good king won't go and take over another kingdom just because, you know, he's very, you know, over-enthusiastic or very greedy or very like that. The only reason is if his own subjects are in danger or the subjects in the next kingdom are in danger. So then in this way, then there may be politics and fighting and all those kind of things. But otherwise, there's no need. You know? Like that. If it wasn't for, you know, Shakuni and all that, then, you know, he wouldn't have been encouraged that much. And he would have just remained he would have just remained, you know, doing his thing, and they would have split up the kingdoms, and it would have remained like that. You know, and one would have had half, and the other would have had the other half. Like that. But because of Shakuni's encouragement, then, you know, all these things came to pass, that then there's a very great war. Because that's Krishna's plan. Krishna's come to destroy the demons. And so then, this is how he's doing it. He's doing it through the, you know, agency basically of Shakuni enthusing Duryodhana. That's why Krishna tells the Pandavas that actually, unknown to them, Shakuni is their best, you know, how you say, friend. You know, he's their best ally. And they're all saying, Shakuni, what do you mean? He's the one that gets Duryodhana all fired up. And he says, yes, because of him, Duryodhana will be destroyed. You know, otherwise Duryodhana wouldn't be. You know, he'd be a little more careful. He does now and again get the other side. He loses his self-confidence, self-esteem, and his drive, and then decides to just, you know, not push so much. But then Shakuni Mama is always there to again reinstate his confidence and his false ego and all those kind of things. And then, you know, because the whole purpose is that all these unqualified kings must be removed, like that. Otherwise, you could imagine if they were still around the Kali Yuga, how much problem they'd make. You know, a lot of problem. You want to say? Louder? Yeah. Yeah, Shakuni he specifically planned that. He was left with the responsibility by his whole dynasty to destroy Duryodhana. You know, so Duryodhana is quite powerful in his own right. He is one of, what, five persons who have the strength of 10,000 elephants? Like that. So there's not many people who can give him problems like that. So then, you know, so this is just how he did it. Because this way, him, all his brothers, his whole dynasty, everything's wiped out. Rather than just get Duryodhana, get the whole dynasty, right? Duryodhana destroyed his dynasty, so Shakuni will arrange to see that Duryodhana's dynasty is destroyed.
That was a plan from Shakuni?
Oh, you don't know that story? See, when Duryodhana was still young, he was, you know, the prince. You know, he had some similar natures like Vena. You know, so one time, I'm not sure how it happened, then Shakuni's family, they're from Gandhar. I think they're related to Gandhari, aren't they? Yeah, Gandhari's from that family. So I guess they were relatives or this or that, you know, from that way. But then somehow they displeased him. He took the whole dynasty and locked them up in a dungeon. And then, to add insult to injury, they would put, you know, into the dungeon enough food for one person. Even though there were, I don't know, what, hundreds or thousands? There were thousands of people in the dungeon, but he would put one person's food in there, right? If you put no food, that's one thing, you know? But if you only put one person's food, then that's like an insult, right? Like that. So then, you know, all the elders got together and thought, we got to get this guy. You know, it's bad enough, you know, what he's doing, but then he's, you know, insult to injury here. So they decided that, okay, they'll choose from them the youngest, most clever, you know, most able person. And that was Shakuni. And they said, they arranged that he will eat the food. It was enough for one person, so he would live very nicely. So then he will live, and his sole purpose is to destroy Duryodhana and his whole dynasty. Like that. It's just to revenge the family. So then, and they told him, I think it was the eldest, whoever was the senior most, the grandfather, great-grandfather, whatever, that when he dies, he's to take his knuckles and make dice out of that. And those dice, then whatever he throws, that will come up. Whatever he wants. If he says 5, when he throws it, it'll come 5. If he says 10, if he throws it, it'll come 10. You know? And with these, that's actually how he destroyed them. Because it was the gambling match that actually, you know, split everything. Because the war was going to be caused because of Draupadi. Because Drona, I mean, it's all so interconnected. Drona is going to be killed by Drishtadyumna. But he can only be killed if there's a war. And that war is caused because Draupadi is insulted. Right? You know, because it also mentions the Manusamhita. You insult a chaste woman, not only the person who does the insulting, the whole dynasty will be destroyed. So here he's got him to the point where now it's guaranteed. Like, otherwise, it may not be guaranteed his whole dynasty is going to be destroyed. But he gets him, Duryodhana, to the point where he insults a chaste woman. Right? He encourages that. Right? Because then he knows they'll all be destroyed. On his own side, it doesn't matter if he'll die for it. You know, he's only living to avenge the family. You know, the Kshatriyas, you know, they do these things. You know, so that's all. So therefore, his whole plan was just to destroy. Even though things were very obvious, like Krishna was God, you know, and he's on the Pandava's side, but Shakuni, you know, soon would relieve what do you call it, Duryodhana of these fleeting moments of Krishna consciousness, you know, by telling him, oh, you know, Krishna, it's just mystic potency, don't worry about it, you know. Like when Krishna shows his partial universal form to Duryodhana to, you know, kind of teach, you know, give him the idea he shouldn't mess around with God and his devotees, Duryodhana decides that's it, you know, I'm giving up going to the forest, you know, forget it, you know, I shouldn't be doing all this stuff. And then Shakuni tells, no, it's just all illusion, you know, it's just some mystic potency, don't worry about it, you know, like that. You know? So that's Shakuni. I mean, it was planned. You know? Yeah. More loud? To who?
So yes. love is adaptive, you know what you want to do is you want to kill him. He said, no, the Kshatriya, you don't fight somebody who doesn't have weapons. He's attacking you with words, you should fight that with your words. Next time he tells you that you are son of a widow, you should tell him you are the son of the widow of an Ashoka tree.
Son of?
A widow of an Ashoka tree.
Tell that to Duryodhana.
Who made this public knowledge? And then he said so and so. So and so was Shakuni's dynasty's head. Therefore, she also didn't understand dynasty. And during this, the entire dynasty understood that it was dynasty.
Oh, he's doing it because the head of the family let it be known.
Yeah.
Oh, otherwise, it was a secret.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, so that's the reason that he stuck them all in the dungeon. Oh. Yes. That's why it mentions that the Kshatriya should be meek and they should be, you know, gentle and all these things. So very powerful. That's why Yudhishthir is the ideal king, not Bhima. You know? Bhima is a great devotee, but he's a little bit more passionate than you would want for a ideal king. Like you see, Ramachandra's not like that, Prithu's not like that, you know, Rishabdev and Ranti Dev and Priyavrata, they're not like that. While you see, Uttanapada had that kind of a little bit of a streak in him and it got him in trouble. Like that. You know, so one always has to see is that if there's too much passion, it's not good either. So the Kshatriyas also have to be careful of that side. You know, in using their prowess, they can't become proud of it or bewildered by it. They have to be able to control it. You know, yes.
I was remembering something in Bhagavatam was talking about the meaning of Ishvara Bala.
Mm.
And we use it quite frequently in ISKCON with a completely different connotation than what Prabhupada can talk for.
Hmm.
And so the Ishvara Bhav actually means one who takes, gets his like strength or his taste from protecting the people.
Hmm.
Completely different. We tend to use it in terms of dominating. And
yeah, because that's the Malecha. The Malecha kings exploit the subjects, while the Vedic concept is that you protect. So Ishvara Bhav also, you have family, you're the protector of the family, or you're protector of your business, or you're protector. That's the Suridam Sarva Bhutanam, you know, somebody opens a big charity and they feel real good that they're helping the people and protecting the people, and it's Ishvara Bhav, because Krishna is the Ishvara, so he protects everyone, he's the lord of everyone, he's the enjoyer of everything. So generally the Malecha concept is exploitation and just being too avaricious and, you know, what is it? All these different words they use. The imperialism and
megalomania.
Huh? Megalomania. But everything means all the other places in the world use all these terms. Imperial, you know, Western imperialism, you know, colonialism, you know.
Well, it's there everywhere. I mean, yesterday was the first day of the Bengal New Year.
Huh.
I had to go to Navadvip for some things. And the whole worship was Ganesh and Lakshmi. They all think they're Purush.
Yeah.
Into this Shakti Puja. The whole mentality, the whole market was stacked.
Yeah.
The hill with Lakshmi and Ganesh. And
yeah.
Nobody else in sight. No Purush in sight.
Yeah. They went Shubh and Lab. Things should be auspicious and there should be profit. That's the end of the chapter. What is, what time is it? Huh? 25 past. Okay. Then. Next chapter, the chapter summary, is the last chapter was called The Perfect Society for Social Classes, and this is The Perfect Society for Spiritual Classes. This chapter particularly describes the brahmachari and the person in the vanaprastha stage. It also gives a general description of the four ashrams, brahmachari, grihastha, vanaprastha, and sannyas. In the previous chapter, the great saint Narad Muni has described the varna institution of society. And now, in this chapter, he will describe the stages of spiritual advancement in the four ashramas, which are known as brahmacharya, grihastha, vanaprastha, and sannyas. The brahmachari should live under the care of the true spiritual master, giving him sincere respect and obeisances, acting as his menial servant, and always carrying out his order. The brahmachari should engage himself in spiritual activities and study the Vedic literature under the direction of the spiritual master. According to the brahmacharya system, he should dress with a belt, deerskin, and matted hair, and should bear a danda, water pot, and sacred thread. He should collect alms daily in the morning, and in the evening, whatever alms he has collected, he should offer to the spiritual master. A brahmachari should accept prasad upon the order of the spiritual master. And if the spiritual master sometimes forgets to order the disciple to eat, the disciple should not take prasad on his own initiative. Rather, he should fast. The brahmachari should be trained to be satisfied with eating what is absolutely necessary. He should be very expert in executing responsibilities. He should be faithful, and he should control his senses and try to avoid the association of women as far as possible. A brahmachari should very strictly abstain from living with women and should not meet with grihasthas and those too addicted to women. Nor should a brahmachari speak in a lonely place with a woman. After completing one's education as a brahmachari in this way, one should give dakshin, an offering of gratitude, to one's guru, and then one may leave for home and accept the next ashram, grihastha ashram, or else one may continue in the brahmachari ashram without adulteration. The duties for the grihastha ashram and the brahmacharya ashram, as well as the duties for sannyas, are prescribed in the shastras. A grihastha is not meant to enjoy sex life without restriction. Indeed, the whole purpose of Vedic life is to become free from sexual indulgence. All the ashrams are recognized for spiritual progress, and therefore, although the grihastha ashram gives a kind of license for sex life for a certain time, it does not allow unrestricted sex life. Therefore, in grihastha life also, there is no illicit sex. A grihastha should not accept a woman for sensual enjoyment. Wasting semen is also illicit sex. After the grihastha ashram is another ashram, known as vanaprastha, which is midway between grihastha and sannyas. A person in the vanaprastha order is restricted in eating food grains and forbidden to eat fruits that have not ripened on the tree. Nor should he cook food with fire, although he is allowed to eat chardu, grains that have been offered in a sacrificial fire. He may also eat fruits and grains that have grown naturally. Living in a thatched cottage, the vanaprastha should endure all kinds of heat and cold. He should not cut his nails or hair, and should give up cleaning his body and teeth. He should wear tree bark, accept a danda, and practice life in the forest, taking a vow to live there for 12 years, 8 years, 4 years, 2 years, or at least 1 year. At last, when because of old age he can no longer perform the activities of a vanaprastha, he should gradually stop everything and in this way give up his body. Text 1. Narad Muni said, a student should practice completely controlling his senses. He should be submissive and should have an attitude of firm friendship for the spiritual master. With a great vow, the brahmachari should live at the Gurukula only for the benefit of the guru. At both junctions of day and night, namely in the early morning and in the evening, he should be fully absorbed in thoughts of the spiritual master, fire, the sun god, and Lord Vishnu, and by chanting the Gayatri mantra, he should worship them. Being called by the spiritual master, the student should study the Vedic mantras regularly. Every day before beginning his studies and at the end of his studies, the disciple should respectfully offer obeisances unto the spiritual master. Carrying carrying pure kusa grass in his hand, the brahmachari should dress regularly with a belt of straw and with deerskin garments. He should wear matted hair, carry a rod and water pot, and be decorated with a sacred thread, as recommended in the shastras. The brahmachari should go out morning and evening to collect alms, and he should offer all that he collects to the spiritual master. He should only eat if ordered to take food by the spiritual master. Otherwise, if the spiritual master does not give this order, he may sometimes have to fast. The brahmachari should be quite well behaved and gentle, and should not eat or collect more than necessary. He must always be active and expert, fully believing in the instructions of the spiritual master and the shastra. Fully controlling his senses, he should associate only as much as necessary with women or those controlled by women. Purport. A brahmachari should be very careful not to mix with women or with men addicted to women. Although when he goes out to beg alms, it is necessary to talk with women and with men very much attached to women. This association should be very short, and he should talk with them only about begging alms and not more. Brahmachari should be very careful in the associating with men who are attached to women. The whole idea of the brahmachari ashram is to develop the fundamental understandings. We're not the body, that we're servant of Krishna. And so then all these activities must be done. The emphasis is on service attitude. You'll see that always it's mentioned first the menial service, the menial attitude that's there. Then it will talk about study. It's always mentioning first is the service attitude. The mood of firm friendship, which means that closeness on the, how do you say, devotional activities that are being performed, and the faith in what is being spoken, that this is good for their benefit. So these are all different aspects that are done there. So this must be very careful. So when they are fixed in this, then they can move in the world and not be affected. Therefore it points out here that the men attached to women, because those who are not trained very well, then they will be overly attached. It's understood that the grihastha is married because there is some emotional needs there, emotional attachments are there, but they are not specifically attached to women in the mood of trying to enjoy. So, but they are cooperating with the wife to create an atmosphere of Krishna consciousness in which both can go back to Godhead. So if the brahmachari is trained in this, then on graduation he can become a good grihastha. Otherwise he won't. Then he will also become a man who is attached to women. So this element is there, is that one goes out, but one only in performance of one's duties discusses or associates based on those duties. Then one is protected. One doesn't associate outside of that. So one is begging, one only discusses begging. And that's all. So whatever the service is, that's all that's being discussed. Then it becomes very easy for them. Then they become trained. Because in the beginning, one must be able to separate. One must be able to identify that here is the senses and here are the sense objects. And how the senses function and how the sense objects function. And when they come together, then what's the result? So only when one is away from it, one can see it very clearly. Right? The saying in English, you can't see the forest for the trees. Someone's so absorbed in whatever they're doing, they can't actually even see what's going on around them. Everybody else can see, but they can't see. So you have to step back from that. Then you can see. So the brahmachari means he steps back from the materialistic life to see it very clearly and understand what is life in the material world. What is actually? So the real brahmachari training is the realistic understanding of the real material world. And if one doesn't go through that training, one actually does not have a clear understanding of the material world. Like that. One, of course, can gain it whenever one studies and associates with devotees. But the point is at an age when one cannot take up great responsibility in the world, this is an ideal time to learn what is the world and prepare oneself for it. So the brahmacharis then would then live in this way so they could understand this. Then only later they can see how this can be put together, right? How the senses and the sub objects can be matched so that they can still be used in Krishna's service. Otherwise, the untrained person, when the senses meet the sense objects, there will just be sense gratification. But for the trained person, when the senses meet the sense objects, then there is service to Krishna. Because they know how to not engage in sense gratification, but engage that in the Lord's service. Therefore, Prabhupada says, a somewhat or seeming license for sense gratification. Because it's not. It has the external form of sense gratification, but that's not its purpose or what's going on. Like that, in someone who's trained. So that's why they must be very, very careful and live in these ways. And they see things as they are. Right? They see. They don't bother with making themselves beautiful, this and that. So they don't get worried about what they look like. Therefore, if you spend the first, you know, so many years of your life, especially Prabhupada recommends up to 25, not worrying about what you look like, what you dress like, what you look like, then when you get married, then okay, you'll just see that your dhoti's put on a little nicely, you know, like that, and, you know, it looks a little decent, like that, and, you know, you keep your sikha a little nicely, put on your tilak a little nicely, like that, and that's it. You know, for someone who's come up with that kind of training, you know, that's really, you know, going all out, you know. Really dressing really, really dapper, you know. It's just that they put on the dhoti, you know, properly. You know. So, but if one grows up where one is very conscious of, you know, dressing for, you know, social kind of standing, then what's it going to be like when one gets absorbed in that? You know, I mean, what's it? Below Japan, there's that big island. Philippine. Yeah, so the wife of the president, her name was Marcos, she had 2,000 or 3,000 such as shoes. Right? So this is called untrained. Right? You know, you don't need that many shoes. You know? Unless you wear, you know, 50 pairs a day or something. I mean, if you wear one pair a day, I mean, how long, you wouldn't, every couple of years, you know what, every 10 years you would wear one pair of shoes. So it's unnecessary. So there's a lack of training. But because one grows up already thinking about these things too much, then one can't function properly. So the brahmacharya must be separated from that. So then he is actually able to do. That's the interesting thing, is the material world is so, because it's energy, one must always understand, what you see, it's always something else. So, what looks real is not real, and what's real looks unreal. You know, so what one thinks, oh, we'll prepare the brahmacharis nicely for, you know, the future life by giving them money and nice dress, and they can kind of do whatever they like, and you know, do all these different things, then they'll be prepared for the world, but they're actually totally unprepared for the world. Those that go through some regulation and all that, then they're prepared for the world. Because if you look around, anyone who is actually in a solid position in the material world is regulated. You know? Like that. So that's the thing. You know? Maybe, you know. So, That's the idea, is the brahmacharya must be trained in this way. Otherwise they'll be useless. They'll just be another useless member of the society. And yes.
Otherwise, in Niti Shastra, if somebody is very much concerned about his outlook, then he can study, he can learn. Knowledge is not attracted to him. Only somebody who is very simple and is not very concerned about his bodily features and dress, and he can acquire knowledge when
he's knowledge. Oh, yeah. The point is, you could hear? Mm-hmm. His point was, in the Niti Shastra, it says someone who's very worried about, you know, what they look like and their social standing can't study. Their mind's already preoccupied. Someone who doesn't worry about that, they can study. Like that. Because the mind has no preoccupation. Like that. So the idea is the mind only has so much space. So therefore, you only keep the most important things in the mind. So if you fill it up with all kinds of, you know, fashion programs, then there'll be no space on the hard drive for more, important programs. So if those are all removed, then you have so much space for nice shastric study. Right? Yes.
And actually, that can be seen as a proof, even in the scientists, all those so-called geniuses, they can just not wear any clothes properly. They They cannot find the glasses, anything. The clothes, the way they go somewhere, even if they have a big class or something, a lecture, they look literally ridiculous because they are so much absorbed in their thinking and whatever they are studying. Although they're studying mundane things, but still, this is a proof
the principle is there, You could hear that?
Mm.
Yeah. Say it louder. Oh, everything. Didn't matter which pants or which shirt, it all matched. That's good. The what is his name? Someone told me that Einstein, some friend or some acquaintance, and asked him for his phone number. Came to his house or something and asked for his phone number. He says, "Oh, 1 minute, I'll go look it up." And they're thinking, Einstein's going to look up his phone number? This guy says, has numbers, so big in his head and he can't remember his phone number. He says, ask him, why is it that you don't remember your phone number? He says, well, there's only so much space in the mind. Why I should bother filling my mind up with numbers and all that I can just write down and keep in a little book? I keep stuff in my head that I can't write down like that. So therefore, he wouldn't even bother trying to remember his phone number. Hey, look in his book.
Just to come back to the point that you previously described, Maharaj, about this brahmachari training. What happens if this brahmachari, throughout his years, living in this material world, some material desires are coming up in his heart, which is natural, and then they are not fulfilled, especially acquiring material things? Isn't there the danger that will distract him much more when he gets the opportunity, when he changes his ashram, that he indulges to satisfy those unfulfilled desires?
Mm. The aspect comes up, there's a few ways you can look at it. One is, who in the history of the world has ever been satisfied with material desires? That's the first thing. So the whole idea is, the training is, you can never be satisfied with them. Only a fool will say they can be satisfied. And that's with a capital F. Doesn't matter if they're wearing tilak, doesn't matter who they're initiated by, doesn't matter who they are. If they actually think you can become satisfied, they're fools. If they think they can become a little satisfied, they're fools. The mind, simply, it has a desire. If it gets that, it thinks it's happy. It doesn't matter what it is. That's why it said one man's food is another man's poison. Somebody, if they just get this car, their mind is satisfied. Someone else, they would never dream of getting that car. If you gave them that car, they'd feel in total anxiety. Like that. So it's simply a figment of the imagination of what you want and what you don't want. What are the desires? So the whole concept of the brahmachari training is to teach them how to deal with desire and how to control that. Because when one deals in the world, one has to deal with material desire. Without desire, no one functions. So you have to learn how to identify that desire is there and not be controlled by it. And then one can step by step try to fulfill those desires according to the need. So therefore, the brahmachari training is the actual process to fulfill that. I mean, what is there to fulfill when you're a kid? Right? Can they become a big corporate manager? Can they become head of a country? Can they become a PhD at the university and, emeritus professor? Are they supposed to be having sex when they're teenagers? Are they supposed to be having all kinds of fancy this and that? I mean, what is it that you can get at that age that can really Where do they get those material desires from? That's the other thing. Are the parents giving them? Do the parents, are they allowing the kids to have what they want? It's not uncommon that I've seen, 40-year-old parents, they don't mind that their kids do all kinds of wild things. They would be doing those things, but they're 40 years old. It looks bad. Right? When you're 40 years old, you can't wear some of the fashions. It looks funny. But their kids wear them, then they encourage you. You know? The wife is dutiful and all this and that and doesn't really like it and all that, but she understands social implications and that, but she's very happy to encourage her daughter to just go through boyfriend after boyfriend. And I'm talking about devotees, I'm not talking about karmis here. Because it's just, they have their own desires. So now where is the kid getting those ideas? One, he's conceived from those parents, so they gave the ideas. So if there are these material desires, they have to blame themselves. They attract the soul according to their consciousness at the time of conception. If someone says, well, that's not very easy to control, then that's due to training. Because the Shastras talk about it so openly. Right? No Westerner will talk. The moment of conception is like sacred in Western tradition. That's a moment to be savored by the two parties as the ultimate in sense gratification. Very personal. Unapproachable. It's a citadel of, unapproachable secrecy. But in the Vedic culture, you make charts according to that because they know exactly the time. They've chosen it beforehand. They come to the Brahmins and say, we would like to conceive a child like this, and this is the time, this is the cycle that the wife goes through. Can you pick us a good time for this child? And then okay, on this day between 10:30 and 11 o'clock, this is a good time. Right? It's very open. Because they know at the moment of conception they have to be remembering something a little auspicious. Not just, 2 millimeter, half a millimeter of skin. So because that's practiced, therefore you end up with these very wild, wild kids, even as devotees. Because at the moment of conception, God only knows what they were thinking of. Because there was no plan. There's no plan at all. It just happened whenever they felt like it. Very, very much, How many times do you hear even devotees say that the child was not planned? Right? So what does that mean? It's just the modes of nature. This is not an elevated conception. So the whole idea is that they would know what they're doing. And they would know the responsibility of conceiving children and raising children. So therefore, everything would be planned. And then they would have first-class children. So if you can plan like that, then what kind of child do you get? Someone who is very regulated and planned and can control the senses. The parents can control the senses. They're going to have sex. But it's planned. It's controlled for a purpose. So that means, what is that child going to be able to do? Use their senses in a controlled way for the purpose of Krishna consciousness. Yes? It's just, it's mathematical. It's science. But somehow or another we have it to some wonderful this and that, which is not. Right? It's not. It's not at all. Nothing glorious. So then, that is the problem. Parents have children and aren't very qualified, and then they're going to blame the educational system that could possibly benefit them. Right? So that is one way of looking at it. I said there's many ways of looking. So that I've explained one way of looking at it. The other way of looking at it is that actually they're right. The child does not have any higher qualifications. They should stay at the home and be raised in the family as a Shudra. Shudras live in the house and never go to Gurukul. Brahmin, Kshatriyas, Vaishyas, they can handle going to Gurukul and get benefit from it. But if by going to Gurukul there's going to be complete unhinging of the, of the emotional structure of the kid, they shouldn't go. It's nonsense that they go to the Gurukul. Shudras should live at home. You know? In other words, a devotee who Shudra side is more important than the devotional side should live at home. But if the devotional side is more important, then it doesn't matter, because a devotee is automatically has a Brahminical culture. But if the conditioned nature is more important than the Krishna conscious, then that will stand out, and Shudras shouldn't go to the Gurukul. Right? As devotees, they can. As non-devotees, they shouldn't. So then they should stay at home. And then their parents should enjoy the sweet rice. They should enjoy the early teenage. You know, especially the mother. You know? Mothers, you know, very much enjoy, 13-year-old kids, boys. You know, you can ask. Go around in the community, ask here how much they're enjoying. You know? It drives them nuts. Because they're attached to their kid, they're happy to have them at home. But the Vedic culture, they're not attached to their kid. They have affection for their kids. There's a world of difference. Attachment, I'm just attached because it came from me. I'm attached to it. Affection means what is best for that individual, that's what I must do. Take my considerations aside, I will benefit that person. That's my responsibility. I have the emotion, I find in myself the emotional, desires for doing these kind of activities of that husband, wife, and parent and child relationship. So I take the responsibility to give an opportunity for a qualified soul to come into the world, and then I help them however I can to get them through and liberate them from death. That's grihastha. That's the meaning of it. That's what it's for. So if I can do that, that's nice. That's Krishna conscious. But if that's affection. And from that affection, naturally, whatever you associate with, some attachment comes. But if it's just attachment, you just want that body around. You don't even really recognize the subtle body. Right? Because when they hit teenage years, they thumb the nose of their parents anyway and do whatever they want to do. You know? So the affection, actually, if you look, is not very deep. Attachment is very deep. But not affection. That's another realm. Affection comes from, duties and proper behavior. Attachment is just, born, it just comes with the body, association. Yeah, it's the senses. It's based on the senses. Well, affection's based on the mind. And Krishna consciousness is based on the soul. So there are three different levels. It's all very similar. Because one is just a perversion of the last. You pervert the spiritual, you get the material emotional platform. You pervert spiritual rasa, you get emotional material rasa. You pervert that, you get the senses. It's working on the same principle. Like that. So you just have to know what you're dealing with. Then so many problems go away. Because devotees haven't addressed, they're afraid to address the emotional platform. They're actually afraid. Because that means so much restriction and so much, surrender on their part, even for a material relationship, that they're afraid of it. How much do they have to give? You want to taste the emotional platform, you have to give something. Right? Nothing comes for free. You want sense gratification, you got to work. Then, to that degree you work, you get the return of the senses. You want exchange on the emotional platform, you have to work. There must be sacrifice. And if you want spiritual, there must be sacrifice on that platform. So the ultimate thing is you engage, you sacrifice everything for the spiritual, and in doing that, the process of vaidhi is to engage the emotional thing, platform according to the rules, and engage the senses according to the rules. Then this becomes bhakti. Then it goes into a whole another realm. It's so much more nice. Like discussing nectar devotion is much nicer than discussing manusmriti. Right? But the point is the one is reflected from the other. Manusmriti is reflected from the nectar devotion. So to engage the body and the emotions, you have the manusmriti. You know? But the whole mood in which that's done, that's the nectar of devotion. Like that. So when they has to see the connection to all this, then it works very nicely. So that's the choice. If one is really worried that if they don't have plenty of money in their pocket, aren't wearing the latest, you know, fashion, you know, and sunglasses and running around with the girls and eating all kinds of crazy stuff, then keep them at home. Don't send them to the Gurukul. Do both, you know, well, you don't do the kid a favor, don't really do yourself a favor, you sure do the school a favor, you know, by keeping him at home. You know, you really do the school a favor. Like that. So that's one has to choose. But otherwise, I mean, the kings before, now, does the king have more or less facilities than probably any of the devotees in our movement have? The king has more or less? More, yes. Even you take, we have a handful of millionaires. They probably, I would expect, have a little bit more than that. Right? Okay. Now, those kings are able to function in that atmosphere and be very Krishna conscious. And not only that, but benefit so many others. And they went to the Gurukul, where their senses were restricted. They didn't have any money. They begged. They just did whatever the teacher told them, studied whatever the teacher told them, did menial service. Right? Then they are able to become a leader of society. Right? Because if the king has to have so much opulence to function, you have to manage so much stuff. The more you have to manage, the more stuff you have to have to manage it. So within that atmosphere, they don't get bewildered. Now, is that controlled senses or not? So that means the senses have to be more controlled. The higher up you want to go, the more controlled they have to be. Now, if you want to get a whole kingdom to render service, now can someone who they themselves can do no service do accomplish that? No, you can't get people to do stuff that you can't do yourself. So therefore, he has the best service attitude. Therefore, everybody has the best service. That means render so much nice service for the king. The king has so much respect for his guru, therefore the whole kingdom has respect for him. Right? He has no money as a brahmachari because he knows all whatever I gain belongs to the teacher. So then, therefore, as a king who has so much wealth, he knows that all this wealth belongs to the Lord. And it's for the purpose of protecting the Lord's people. So therefore, he can function. So the idea is that if the children don't have all these things, they'll grow up weird as a 101% uninformed opinion. They neither know they don't actually know the psychology of humans and how they function. They don't know Varnashram and the social structure and how it works. And they don't actually understand the emotional platform. And they don't understand their duties as parents, that they're supposed to liberate their child from death. If they can't do that, why do they become parents? Right? Then it's just a cheap thing. Then it was a selfish whole idea to have the children. But if you have the child for the purpose that I will help in whatever way I can, whatever little I know, to save this person from death, train them in Krishna consciousness, give them the culture and the tools necessary for that. That's the main thing. Secondary thing is how to feed yourself. Right? 12th canto says it's the other way around in Kali Yuga. If you can maintain a household, you're considered a very great personality. Previously, yugas, if you were Krishna conscious, you were considered a great personality. Because according to your karma, you're going to get whatever you're going to get to eat, whether you try or not. Right? Whether we work or not, whatever is due to you, you're going to get. Right? But because we have to do something, we're active by nature, we have desire, therefore we act according to our duty, our position, our varna and ashram. So that's That's, we do that to please the Lord. And then the Lord, according to his desire, he takes care of us. So it's not that I'm going out and getting a job that I'm feeding myself. There's plenty of people who have jobs who have difficulty. There's plenty of people who don't have jobs who have no difficulty. One man works 8 hours a day, you know, and gets, you know, a few rupees. Another man works same time in the day, gets hundreds of thousands of dollars. So where'd that come from? That's just karma. Right? There's plenty of big businessmen. I mean, right in Calcutta, there's people there who cannot read or write. And they're millionaires. Not in rupees, in US dollars. Right in Calcutta. They need to read or write, they hire a guy. It's there today. I was just speaking with a Marwari businessman the other day, and he was telling me. There are people there today. Big, fat guys. You know, can't even fit through the door practically. They're so rich. Right? A Marwari will not get fat unless they're rich. So the fatter the Marwari means the richer the guy is. So these are big, huge, fat guys. Right? And they can't read or write. They don't have to. They just know money. And they make it. They don't, you know. So it's like, you know. It's the way it goes. Whatever is due to you, you're going to get. But the point is you must be trained to engage your nature in Krishna's service. Right? This fat Marwari is using his nature as a businessman. And he's performing it. Now he just has to use it for Krishna. Education means that you educate everyone according to their nature. Everyone talks about individuality. It's like, you know, one of the dearmost words in the New Age, you know, thing. But they expect the same exact patented textbook education for everybody. So what's that got to do with individuality? Everybody's different, and they expect exact same education for everybody. So it's not, it's impersonal. There's no, the modern culture is no personal. There's no actual understanding of personalism in the West. You know? Even the monotheistic religions are impersonal. Because when they get up to the God level, it's like he's impersonal. He has no form, no this, no that. They'll tell you that. God is, you know, God, he sent his son, right? But then what does God look like? Oh, he has no form. You know, Muhammad, you know, or prophet, like that, you can't show his face. Right? Like that. Judaism, very much impersonal. You know, Buddhism is impersonal, Jainism is impersonal. So how can anything below that actually be factually personal? So only the Vedic really has personal dealings. So therefore they deal with each one individually. Right? It may look, okay, then we may say, but they're all going through the same education, they're all being brahmacharis and this and that. But they're dealt with each one individually. It's all based on the relationship, right? It's totally the relationship between the student and the teacher. That's the thing. The you see that the academics is discussed secondary. And when we're discussing that, it's still the respect and the exchange between them. That's the main thing. Modern, you know, is result-oriented. What are they going to get at the end, right? You want to discuss what is a school for. You must have your, what is it called? Mission statement. Then that must be broken down into objectives. And those objectives can't be subtle. They have to be tangible. I can see it. I can touch it with my senses. It has to be an unamoy statement. You know, if it's anything higher, forget it. It's not practical. It's not real. Real means I can touch my senses. Any You know, buffalo can walk in and go, yes, you're getting your statements. But if you talk about subtleties, about the proper attitudes and this and that, well, how do you see the attitude? I have to be less concrete. And if you bring it down to concrete, people are shocked. You know? Concrete. How the guy puts on his dhoti. You know? Just how he keeps his things in his locker. How he dealt with the boy next to him. What was the tone of his voice? At the pumps, how did they do? You're standing there, the other guy's bathing, you just stand there. Failed. Right? The other guy's bathing, you're not brushing your teeth, you pump. Passed. You know? These are the real things. But these aren't the things people are looking for. They're not looking for that at all. So, like that, one has to be... one has to know the higher principles. Because human life means subtle. Animal life means gross. Animal life means you got to be able to smell it. You know, you can smell it, then it's got some substance. Smells like something to eat, it's okay. It doesn't. Has no meaning. So human life is meant for more subtleties, because the ultimate subtlety is then Krishna consciousness. So the individuality is all based on the actual exchange and relationships that go on. That's what's looked for in the school. It means any kid with half a brain can learn the Vedic knowledge. But a teacher tests them for 1 year. Why? To see if they can learn it in the way that they can give it. And they can bring out of them the qualities that they can offer. Right? Let's say someone has the ability to bring out, very good at presentation. You know? So then they look for a student that has those qualities. If they don't have those qualities, they won't teach them. They'll say you should find a different teacher. Because the student may not have that. They may have another qualities. They're very expert in puja. That's their interest. So unless that teacher can teach that, then he should send them to another teacher who specializes in puja. So it becomes very individual. Very individual. And that's also very much misunderstood. Everyone wants very general, broad schools. You can stick anything in it, and outside it'll come out perfect. You know, you have one school, you put them in, you know, and after so many years, they either come out as, you know, top rate, you know, high court, you know, judge, or they come out, you know, neuro brain surgeon, like that, or they come out, you know, commander in chief of the, you know, NATO forces, or they come out as, you know, chairman of the World Bank, you know, or they come out with, you know, top singer and, you know, lead band, or in, you know, whatever may be their field. You know, one school does it, right? Isn't that the way the karmis do it? Right? They have one school and everybody comes out of it, right? Doctors come out of just general school, right? They don't go to a special medical school. Musicians don't go to a special music school. You know, managers don't go to a special management school. You know, business orientation doesn't go to a commerce school. Trades don't go to trade school, right? Isn't that how the karmis do it? Yes? No. Yeah. Means... that's on the lower level, but on the higher level, they do specialize them. Yeah, they specialize them. So, even the idea of specialized gurukuls, many devotees can't relate to them. Many people wonder, how come we got four schools in Mayapur? You know, and the educators here are talking about more schools. We don't have enough schools to deal with the broad range of students that are here. And others are going, why so many? So is this personal or impersonal? And then they talk about, you know, personal dealings, this, that. It's just all, you know, that's just talk. It's not reality.
The quiz that the word personal means you don't just take anybody's senses.
Yes, that's it. Personal means you don't restrict the senses, and impersonal means you do. Right? Because that's, I mean, that's a simple thing. New Age simply means whatever your problem is, it goes back to, you know, some problem when you were small with your, you know, your parents, and that you're restricting your senses, right? So if we just sentimentally talk about when you were a little kid and get it all out, then you're able to enjoy your senses, and then perfection. I up to now never heard one person who deals in New Age, you know, seriously, that they're New Age counselors that don't use that system. I've never heard it. And I'm also including devotees. I mean, who deal in, dabble in the psychology there. Not all, I mean, just pure psychology, but if it's New Age slant, they always deal like that. They always start asking about when you were little, this and that, and so many things, and, you know, like that. And then they always, you know, oh, maybe you're restricting too much, and all that. It's always... So we have to be careful. So we'll end here. Om Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Srila Prabhupada ki, Samaveta Bhaktivedanta ki, Jai Nityagaur Premanandi, Garadhar Pandit ki. Jai.